Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It seems like ancient history already, but the eclipse dominated the news for a few days. And according to some authors, it even did something quite rare. It brought us together in a shared experience. The interesting thing, of course, about the eclipse is there's not really that much to see. It's a dark sky, and we put on our special glasses to perhaps see through that darkness. Most of us, of course, are not professional astronomers of any kind, but my guest today is Lisa Kaltenegger. Is the director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University. She's one of the world's leading authorities on looking at the universe, a leading astrophysicist and astrobiologist. And she has a new book out, Alien Earths, the new science of planet hunting in the cosmos. And she's actually joining us from Carl Sagan's very office at Cornell University. Lisa, what did you do during the eclipse? Did you put the glasses on like the rest of us?
Absolutely. I happened to be up in Burlington, Vermont, because I was giving the keynote of how eclipses, right? We now know that the moon goes between us and the sun, and so we see this gorgeous dark sky and the outer parts of the sun and the structure on the surface of the moon. That's what we all experienced last week or a couple days ago. So basically, that is what we now do for other worlds. Because when a planet goes in front of its sun, its other star, light from the star also gets filtered, but through the planet's atmosphere. And so I connected this discoveries and the knowledge of solar eclipses that we know since thousands of years already to the new exploration on these new worlds on our cosmic shore. And so I got really lucky because it was not cloudy. And you know, it's northeast, it's April 8th. So the chances, I think, that we were not clouded out was 20%. And we had a gorgeous day. So yes, I put on my glasses. And then when it was full total eclipse, I took them off and marveled with everyone around me about how we could understand and know that this would happen, prepare for it, and not be scared like people of old.
Yeah, it's interesting you say not be scared like people of old. For Eclipse Day, we had Christopher Kokinos on the show. He's a poet and a historian of the moon. He's not a hardcore scientist like you. It's intriguing to imagine that people once looked up at events like eclipses and imagined the end of the Earth or the end of the world. And yet, Lisa, and you don't need me to tell you this, we also live in weirdly apocalyptic times. Do you think there's something in us that lends us humans to imagine inevitably the apocalypse?
I think we worry. And I think we worry based on history. And we worry because a lot of times there were a lot of conflict in our history so far. I have high hopes that we're going to develop through that phase, being kind of like an adult phase, right? So growing pains, so to say. But it makes sense that then when we don't understand something, we get scared, because if the sun would never come back out, if the moon stood there, right, and kept being there and it would cold, then the crops wouldn't grow. And oh my God, what else would happen? And so I think our human curiosity allowed us to figure out that this was going to happen and it's going to go away, and that we could relax for the total solar eclipse. And so I think curiosity is one of the key abilities or capabilities of our species that lets us overcome this fear. And I agree, total eclipses were really scary when you had no idea what it was. And sometimes they were used to win wars, and you had that on your show already, so I'm not going in details on that. But the knowledge, if you know something that your opponent doesn't know, you can use that. But now we're at the point where we can share it and celebrate it all together, because it shows us our connection. to this beautiful, beautiful cosmos we live in.
Speaking of colleagues or people that also write about this stuff, I've had the Harvard astronomer, controversial fellow, Avi Loeb, on the show a number of times. He's actually a very entertaining guest. His latest book is Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars. He's controversial because he seems to be almost guaranteeing extraterrestrial life. Do you agree with him?
I think we don't know yet. And I so get that we wish we did. Right, I can completely understand that people think, oh, I think this was life, and I want it to be, because in my lifetime, I really, really want to have signs that we are not alone. And sometimes that is very hard to shake. And sometimes the signals are just, you know, they're always like embedded in a lot of noise. And so it's very hard to interpret. And this is where the scientific method is sometimes being described as a tragedy, you know, a beautiful hypothesis. Oh my God, I found life. And then an ugly fact that just makes it not clear or tells you that it could also be something else. And we've seen this throughout history. So from everything I know, from everything I've seen, there are no credible signs of life yet. But we have this big telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, that for the first time can actually collect enough light from these small planets to figure out what's in their air and if anything's breathing there. But I do have to say, it is the hard way to do it, you know, planet by planet, moon by moon, trying to find signs of life. It'd be so much easier if somebody could convince us, you know, oh, we've been visited, or, oh, this is like a alien spaceship. I wish it were true, but there's no convincing evidence yet. So the search that we now all part of, this time in human history, this golden time of exploration with this big telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope that we launched a little bit more than a year ago, what's about four times my size, basically. It's huge. And so for the first time, it can collect enough light of these other worlds that could be like ours to actually tell us, to give us the data, to tell us if we are alone or not. So we don't have to guess and hope anymore. We are now exploring, and it will take a while, but we are now for the first time having the tools to get the answer.
We'll have to get you on the show with Avi. It'll be an interesting conversation. I'm sure you know him very well. In my conversations with him, actually, I think he almost implied that one of the reasons he was so interested in finding extraterrestrial life was to impress his mother, who was always dominant in his life. There's an interesting piece about you in the New York Times, suggested that you dream of pink planets and alien dinosaurs. I'm guessing Avi Loeb doesn't dream of either pink planets or alien dinosaurs. I'm sure he doesn't even know what a pink planet is. What drives you, or what drove you to your very distinguished career and this interest in other forms of life? Not a mother, I hope. You're not trying to impress a Jewish mother.
I'm not trying to impress anyone. I'm just curious by nature, as I think most of us are, you know, whether we're curious about why is this person laughing at the next table? You know, what's the story? I want to know that too, right? Or we're curious about, ooh, how does the world actually work? Or could you send something to the moon, and how does it work in the first place? To where I kind of thought, well, really, we have the tools to figure out if we're not alone. And so the star I see up there, that I now know also has a planet at the right distance. And now I can help to figure out if that planet might have conditions for life and even signs for life. That's how I got roped in. So I'm doing this because I just want to be part of this surge of this exploration, because we are in this new era of space exploration. And the exploration that happened before is, you know, we went on ships, we found other continents and so on and so forth. But now we find complete other worlds. And we have found more than 5,600 to date circling other stars. So our view is expanding and we have so many worlds to explore now. This is what drives me, why I'm excited. And the article was really, really cool. And so they basically took together all these different ideas on what it takes to find life on another world. It takes creativity, it takes knowledge, it takes people that are connected. And this is why I built the Carl Sagan Institute here at Cornell, because an astrophysicist alone cannot find life in the universe, because you need to understand what the biology is doing. You need to understand what the chemistry is doing. You need to understand what the geology on these worlds are like to not miss signs of life and to also not, you know, see signs that aren't there. So a network of scientists is critical. And so we build, I have with colleagues in a biolab, we build a wide variety of life, because life comes in so many colors. When you go out, you know, you see these different colors, but life comes in a much wider palette of colors than that. And so I want to know what that would look to my telescope. And so things like that need to come into the search to not miss the signs if they're there.
You've mentioned Carl Sagan a couple of times. You're in his office. You founder and you run the Carl Sagan Institute. Just remind everyone who Carl Sagan was. Unfortunately, he's no longer around.
So Carl Sagan was this amazing astronomer, but also this really gifted communicator. And so he took this excitement of space. There were these first missions, the Voyager missions that went to explore the outer realms of our solar system, brought these first images back of the weird moons, you know, where we're now trying to figure out if they could host life here in the solar system too. But what he did, in addition to his very great science, was he shared the mystery of the cosmos and the excitement of science with everyone in this Cosmos TV series and in the book. And that is a lot of people I know, whether they became scientists or engineer, but most of the scientists and engineers I know have at one point read his writing, got interested because he made it accessible. He connected it to the human experience. And you were just talking about, you know, pink planets and dinosaurs, because it's really interesting is this idea that it's not just us that you would try to find out there, because you would find a mixture of gases that you cannot explain with anything except for life. So you see something else breathing. And then the question is it alien dinosaurs? And there we probably all have seen the last movie about this one. But is it dinosaurs? Is it biota? Is it a species that could be akin to ours? What can evolution create? And so all of that also feeds back to humanity, to our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of us in the cosmos. And Carl Sagan put this beautifully in context. And so he brought a lot of people in that maybe sometimes thought that science was dry and not something that was relevant to them. Because we live in this gorgeous, amazing, beautiful cosmos, and all of us are explorers. And for the first time, we are at the verge of finding out if we're alone.
Are we really explorers? Most people I know, Lisa, don't even get out of their neighborhood. Most people live and die where they were born. Why do you believe that we're mostly explorers?
Because I think in each small way, you know, even if you never leave your neighborhood, you explore, you try to figure out what are the neighbors, you know, how can you make connection? What is there? What is the biota? What can you do? You know, it's just whether it's small or big, and in every neighborhood, and this is the experience I have over and over again, people look up at the sky, they see these other stars. And what we know now is that 1 out of 5 of those stars has a planet that could be like ours. 1 out of 5. And in our galaxy, the Milky Way, we have 200 billion stars alone, and there are billions of galaxies. So even if you never leave your backyard, we are living in this incredible time of exploration. And just look up. these are the stars with their worlds that we now starting to explore. And the second part, if you don't care about whether we're alone in the universe, and that's perfectly fine, is that with every other Earth-like planet that we find around another star, circling another star, we learn more about how a world like ours works and how we can keep the different neighborhoods, even if you never leave them, safe and prosperous.
Lots more to discuss. We're going to take a short break. We're speaking with Lisa Kaltenegger, author of a wonderful new book, Alien Earth. She is one of the world's leading astrophysicists, looking up at the world through this magnificent telescope that she talked about, the Webb Space Telescope. And she's in charge of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University. Going to take a short break. When it comes to looking at things, maybe not so much the universe, but the world itself, Liberties does a good job, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, help bring us such amazing guests as Lisa Kaltenegger. Going to run a short feature about Liberties, and then we'll be back with Lisa to talk about the new science of planet hunting in the cosmos, and whether we should or shouldn't be celebrating the potential discovery of new life. So don't go away, anyone. The aliens will be back in a second.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with Lisa Kaltenegger, one of the world's leading observers of the universe, the author of Alien Earth. So, Lisa, before the break, you noted that when we look up at the sky and we see these stars, we should also imagine the possibility of other life forms on planets like our own. There's a strong possibility of that. You suggested that this should be a reason for celebration, but some people might say, well, more fake news, more environmental decay, more selfishness and violence. Is there any reason to be fearful of finding other life forms in the universe?
I think our ideas are very much colored by TV and movies that need a plot. They need to have a conflict so that somebody can rise and, like, I don't know, overpower the aliens, save the Earth. When you think about it, it's like, why would anybody come? Right. So a lot of times things are like, oh, resources. Somebody will come and steal our water or
come
other
to
things.
The earth, you mean? Why
come to the earth, right?
Aliens come.
Should we worry? But basically having the thing is, should we worry that aliens come and actually come to the earth? And it's bad for us because they would be so much more advanced, of course, because they can travel between the stars. But if you want any resources, it's much easier to get those resources in your own planetary system because, you know, these asteroids and these pieces that fly around these other planets, mining them is so much easier than going all the way to another star system. Because when you take our sun and its planets and you shrink it to the size of a cookie, then the next star over, our neighboring star, is about 4 football fields away. So vast distances.
Say that again, Lisa. 4 what away?
Football fields away.
Okay. And so it's not a lot.
No, but if our whole solar system is just the size of a cookie, then in the same scale, 4 football fields is huge and needs a lot of energy, needs a lot of time to actually go over. And light, the fastest thing we know of, needs 4 years to get to the next star. So the distances in the galaxy are vast. So why would you come? If it's resources you're trying to find or you're trying to steal, right, or harvest, then it's much easier to do in your own planetary system. And then sometimes people are like, oh, you know, they're going to come and take us as slaves. I'm like, I'd be such a bad slave, right? Because if you can travel from star to star, you'll have robots who can do lots of things. I need to eat. I need to sleep. You know, I don't carry a lot. So I think our opinion is colored from the stories that have the purpose of getting you, you know, to read a book or to actually be in the movies and cheer for somebody. I think in this vast universe, if there's life, that life that can travel between stars had to have developed to a stage where it's actually not as aggressive anymore, because if not long distances, really long travel times, very small spaces, I think that aggression needs to go out before, for example, we could go for tens and tens of years of travel. And so I think when you think about the context of other aliens, if they're out there, we do not know if there's life in the universe. That's where we're just starting to explore. I actually don't think it's that scary for these reasons. And then a lot of times people ask me, so why is nobody here yet? If there's billions of opportunities, right, to have a planet like ours in our galaxy alone. And there I have a very private answer, because I'm like, well, you know, if there were really a lot of places that could support life and maybe do support life, why would you want to come to us?
Like, yeah, you had an interesting piece actually in Lit Hub derived from the book about this. It's the ultimate insult, of course.
I love our planet.
Why would they come? They'd probably skip us. There are many more interesting things. But I take your point. But let me revise my question earlier. I didn't mean that we're boring. My point is when we look up at the sky and we imagine other forms of life, given what we've done to our planet, given the violence, the history of suffering, the history of other species, dead species now, is there reason to imagine that if there is other life, it's quite as violent and unpleasant as human life? Or maybe I'm wrong on human.
I just think that if you get to the point where you can travel the stars, that's an incredibly hard achievement. Lots of technology needed. Everybody has to pull on the same string. And people, or, you know, however, like for us, let's go with us. We have to learn how to live together and not have these violent tendencies, right? If you look at the ISS, the astronauts and the cosmonauts, and everybody's living together, right? Well, here on the Earth, we have a much harder time doing the living together part in peace. So I think if you fast forward a couple of thousand years, where hopefully we get to the point where even we can go to the next star, it's going to be super hard and it's going to take a lot of technology. I don't think a civilization that stays violent and that stays aggressive will be able to pull this together, to pull the ideas together and to actually coexist on these long space travels. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Certainly will. Lisa, what do you think in terms of coming together and bringing everyone together and doing this collectively? And we have a responsibility, I guess. What do you think of initiatives by private multi-billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos to explore, if not the universe, certainly our solar system, independently of state-supported groups like NASA?
I think if you do it privately, that allows you a lot more flexibility, and it also allows you to use technology that might not have been proven for space. So the advantage here is that if that technology works in space, it's just never been in space, thus it's not proven for space, then it becomes automatically proven for space. And then space agencies that are using tax dollars, right, and have to be very, very responsible about what they can fly and how secure they must be that things work in space, can then use that technology too. So I think, or to me, this private exploration of space is a little bit born out of the frustration of the pace that state agencies have to go, because they have to be very safe and they have to use the tax dollars really, really well, right? You don't want to send something up, it blows up, and then that money is lost. And so I think it's a great combination of exploration. And I also think there's a lot more links between space agencies and these private organizations than you generally see. And some of them actually supply launch capabilities for space agencies. And in reverse, some of NASA actually then gives grants out or gives like money out for them to develop some specific components that helps the private industry. So it goes hand in hand. When we have the capability to just go into space and explore, then the big question will come up. We will need a kind of framework. You know, not anybody can just go to Mars and bring whatever bacteria they want and then, you know, sow it out there and say, oh, Mars has life. I know because I brought it there. But once we're there, we should have that capability in place once we have access for space for more people than just space agencies.
Because it was the Sputnik moment in the early 60s that literally and figuratively launched the American successful mission on the moon. And we seem to be at another Sputnik moment. There's increasing tension, rivalry between the US and China in terms of space travel. Is this one area, Lisa, where humans can actually come together or should come together? Not just the Bezoses and the Musks of the world, but the people who occupy the White House and the people who run China?
Absolutely. And I think if you have a look at scientists, I think scientists are usually the last people who stop talking to each other, like if you think about it internationally, because they are driven by this curiosity about, you know, going to the moon, and they don't want to have to care that they are not from the same country, because this is the idea that they all rally around. And then, of course, financially, it's set up so that each country has their own space agency. But there's no reason why that can't get interlinked like it was for many countries, you know, for the International Space Agency. And like we are planning to do, there was just this announcement between, for example, Japan and the US to go further and explore the moon. But yes, I'm fully with you. Everybody should do this together, because everybody doing the same thing again and again is just making it so much more expensive. And it's going to take so much more time to do it than if everybody pulls their resources and does it together.
Of course, proving life elsewhere or other species is speculative. But you noted earlier that this work has also enabled us to understand ourselves better. That's not speculative. That's real. Explain what you mean. And what do like the work you do, your book, the Carl Sagan Institute, and this new remarkable Webb Space Telescope, how do they help us understand ourselves?
So if we just go for the search for worlds like ours out there, if we find many other rocky planets and we can explore them, that's the next step. That's what we're starting to do right now. Then all these explorations, all this information will tell us how a rocky planet like ours works. Because we are at one point in time, we do have some information about the past, but the rock record becomes harder and harder to read the further you go back in time. And we don't really have any information for the future. We've extrapolation, we can think about what's going to happen. But if you just imagine we found 100 other Earths, some of them younger, some of them older, then piecing together how the evolution of an Earth works will tell us how our planet works too, to a much deeper degree than we can do right now, because we're just stuck in this one moment in time. And the way that I explain it in class a lot is when I say, like, look, it even could give us a view in a potential future. Because if all the other Earths that are older than us, if you found, like, for example, SO2 is sulfur dioxide, it's a gas that comes out of volcanoes, and this is completely hypothetical. But if you were to find that on all the older Earth, then that doesn't mean it has to happen to the Earth, but it would be great to actually develop technology to filter it out of our air, because we can't breathe it, just in case it happens to all Earth. And so the information that we gain from these planets that are like ours but circling other stars can inform us to safeguard our own world. And the other thing that you mentioned before, this exploration of space, one thing that I think a lot of people don't think about so much is that space is incredibly harsh. It's one of the worst environments you could imagine. So you have to perfectly recycle and you have to perfectly clean your water and have a great life support system. There's just no margin for error. You have to do this perfect. But that technology that you develop for space exploration, you can bring back to the Earth, where we don't have to develop that technology because we have resources that we can add. We can pollute, right? Kind of to a certain extent, that's what we're doing. So in that respect, space exploration can also help by bringing that knowledge and that technology back to safeguard our own world.
So you're suggesting space is a little bit like Cambridge, Massachusetts or Berkeley, California?
I think space is way worse than that because I've lived in Boston and I really, really like that. But you just don't get any extra, air. You don't get any extra water once you're on the spaceship. And so you have to know how to do a perfect recycling. And even so, the places you mentioned are great first steps in that direction. Mm. They don't have to 100% recycle either. So the technology might just help us a lot to get this to work here in the Earth too.
Finally, Lisa, it's a wonderfully rich conversation. Congratulations on the new book. A couple of questions I can't resist asking. They're dumb ones, but of course I'm allowed to ask them because they're my show. It's my show. Firstly, what's your favorite sort of science fiction show or movie? Star Wars, Star Trek? Are any of them realistic or are they just absurd, childish fantasies?
I think it depends. The more realistic it gets, sometimes the more boring the story gets, right? Because explosion in space wouldn't have any sound. And so do you want to sit through a movie where things explode and you don't hear anything, except for space, obviously, of course. I really like stories. So I like, for example, Contact. That's like the movie that Carl Sagan wrote about billions and billions. So we were trying to find life in the universe. But I also really, really enjoyed recently, for example, Arrival, just because it played with this concept of actually bringing aliens to the Earth and then having a look and not understanding them, right? Because somehow we kind of tend to think we would understand any message we get. And so I love that aspect of it. And then there's a couple of like Valerio and the City of a Thousand Worlds, right? It's just beautiful in terms of pictures. So I love sci-fi. Also, if you think about Pandora and Avatar, like how much science they put in, but still have a story that they're trying to tell, right? I really enjoy sci-fi, and it is okay if some of the things are not.
Do you think that out here in California, guys like Elon Musk grew up with Star Trek? Is there something rather male about shows like Star Trek?
I think if you have a look at Star Trek, you see the first female officers. Fair enough, the first one was a communication officers, but they played with this way before normal shows did it, right? Because they were fantasy, they were science fiction, so they were allowed to break the stereotype. And so in that sense, when you also have these female captains on the Star Trek shows, right? In that sense, they're actually quite progressive. And so I actually enjoy watching them. And then, there's the last Star Trek, for example, the new series that just started, features a female captain and she's amazing. So, I enjoy science fiction all through. And I try to also bring that into the book. Could that world be real? What could work about it? In which worlds out there, even weirder than anything science fiction had actually imagined?
You noted in Star Trek that the females were fantasies in terms of their positions and power. You were once a fantasy, a very senior astrophysicist. Now you're a reality. Do you think you bring a female quality to your narrative, to your speculation, to this book, Alien Earth?
I think I bring a creativity to it that sometimes is, in older times, was hard to bring to science. Right, there's still a lot, I need to know these things. There's a profound knowledge you have to have, but you can bring a creativity in and you can bring people together that a lot of male colleagues can do too. But it's kind of in the beginning,
even Abby Loeb.
I don't know, it depends on how much you want there to be aliens, yeah. But I think this is also why I wrote the book. I wanted to show that at the forefront of science, where you need so many new ideas to actually solve huge problems, you need lots of different opinions, lots of different ways of thinking about a problem to solve it. And so even so it's harder for some people than others, there's space for everyone, and we're trying to make more and more space for it. And I wanted to write the book so people could hear another voice in this whole idea of science and maybe think, well, maybe there's a space for me. Maybe I want to do that.
And finally, Lisa, dumbest question of all, what are the chances of there being life outside? Avi Loeb, your colleague, says almost 100%. Do you agree?
I think that I love the answer that one of the Nobel Prize winners who found the first planet, Michel Mayor, always gives to the question. He says 50%, plus minus 50. What it basically means is like 0% to 100, because we don't know, but we don't have to guess anymore, because we just have to wait. Because we now have the instrument for the first time ever to actually check. And so it's not wishing anymore. It's not hoping anymore. It's just a little bit more time waiting to figure it out.